From Silicon Valley to Wall Street, the promise and perils of artificial intelligence are playing out on the world stage. But what will the next phase of AI adoption look like? Which companies, from big tech to startups, will dominate? And where do the risks and unintended consequences lie? I'm Emily Chang. Join me at Bloomberg Tech in San Francisco, May 9th, to answer many of the industry's burning questions, alongside Snap's Evan Spiegel, Xbox President Sarah Bond, OpenAI's Brad Lightcap, top researcher Dr. Fei-Fei Li of Stanford, and many more. More details and just a few tickets left at Bloomberg.com/TechSF.
Join Bloomberg in San Francisco or virtually on May 7th for The Future Investor, Data-Powered Transformations. This 2024 event series will examine how data is not only playing a pivotal role in investment decisions, but serves as a driving force behind the construction of innovative investable enterprises. This series is proudly sponsored by Invesco QQQ. Register at BloombergLive.com/FutureInvestor/radio.
Hello and welcome to What Goes Up, a weekly markets podcast. My name is Mike Regan. I'm a senior editor at Bloomberg.
And I'm Valdana Hayek, a cross asset reporter with Bloomberg.
And this week on the show, well, as we sit here today on Wednesday, August 10th, the S&P 500 is now up almost 15% from its bear market low in the middle of June. So is that it? Crisis over? Or is this just another bear market rally that's doomed to fail? And what about those growth stocks? They're up even more after being left for dead for value stocks earlier in the year. We're going to get into it with the chief investment officer for the wealth management unit of a major Wall Street bank who is quite a bit more cautious about this market than the people chasing this ferocious rebound. But first, Valdana, I think as many listeners of the show know, being a podcast co-host such as yourself, it's a very fulfilling job, right?
Yes, it's so fun.
But I think
thanks for having me.
I think listeners have probably picked up on, though, that my real ambition is to be a game show host.
Yeah, I know.
Have you noticed that?
Yeah,
yes.
I've noticed. You're making the transition very slowly.
I know. I'm working on it every week.
Yeah.
I think I need better hair. I need more hairspray and stuff like that. But we'll get there. We'll get there.
I can help you with that.
And regular listeners will know at the end of the show, we do the craziest things we saw in the market that week. And I like to sort of make it like Price is Right.
Mm-hmm.
Although I'm deathly afraid of Bob Barker after seeing Happy Gilmore and seeing him punch out Happy Gilmore. So we can't call it Price is Right anymore.
Yeah, we can't. Not anymore. We got away with it for a long time.
We did. I haven't gotten punched. No angry letters from lawyers. But a listener from London, Chris Whitman of Convergence Value Partners in London, wrote in to suggest what I think is the perfect title that Bob Barker cannot complain at all about.
Which is what?
It is The Price is Precise.
Price is Precise.
Can you say it? It's a tongue twister.
It's hard.
Let me hear you say it.
Well, we know I prefer Price is Correct.
Price is Correct.
Price
yes.
is so we have Price is Correct and now Price is Precise.
I think I like Price is Precise.
I just know I'm gonna mess it up.
The that's
precise
why I like
price.
It better.
The
I
precise
right.
price. Yeah, I know I'll mess it up.
Anyway, well, let's go with it for this week. Anyway,
if anybody else has any suggestions, you can just tweet at us.
Absolutely.
I think that will
absolutely.
Work. But anyway, I do want to bring in our guest. We're really lucky to have her. It's Lisa Shallet, Chief Investment Officer at Morgan Stanley Wealth Management. Thanks so much for joining us, Lisa.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Yeah, Lisa, I wanted to sort of set the stage a little bit here because Morgan Stanley has gotten a lot of attention this year, rightly so, for being correct about being cautious about this market. Your colleague, Mike Wilson, has a year-end target for the S&P at 3,900. Not the lowest on the street, but, you know, well below average, about 500 points below average of the strategists we survey. And, you know, it would mean an 18% drop on the year for the index. And I was reading your weekly note from the Global Investment Committee, which you are the chair of, I believe, the head of. Let me just read the beginning of it. The Global Investment Committee's base case is a profits recession, not an economic recession. Earnings are vulnerable to rising costs, a strong dollar, bulging inventories, and waning pricing power. And then you go on to point out about the hotness in the labor market being sort of, you know, a risk to everything. Today, though, on Wednesday, we got this CPI report that surprised a lot of people. It does, you know, fingers crossed, knock on wood, everything else. It signals perhaps inflation has peaked. Month over month, it was flat. The headline number, I think, was what, down to 8.5%, a very low 8.5% from 9.1. So I'm just curious, does the Wednesday CPI report and the market reaction to it change at all your thinking? You know, does it create any sort of silver linings in the clouds that you see for the economy and the markets?
No, not at all. I mean, look, in fact, the idea that inflation may have peaked, in our humble opinion, may be correct directionally, but may also be a little bit of a head fake. With regard to this idea that, hey, game over, problem solved, the Fed has conquered the day and, you know, Fed credibility is back and all of that. Our guess is a lot of things have gone right here, vis-a-vis energy prices, vis-a-vis global demand in Europe and China in particular, really being much slower than global economists were calling for in the month of July, which has helped ease a lot of supply chain issues, has helped ease and take some of the heat off some of the food parts of inflation. So our guess is that, yeah, directionally this is right, but for the market to be, you know, kind of celebrating as they have been since the middle of June, again, our guess is we're way premature for that.
So Lisa, can you maybe talk a little bit more about that? I want to ask you, how much the CPI print does, to what extent does it relieve pressure on the Fed? And maybe you can talk a bit about what you're expecting from their September meeting and through the rest of the year.
Yeah, absolutely. So look, good news for the Fed is, like I said, direction is correct, right? We are not making new highs in year over year inflation compares. It looks like 9.1%, at least for now, is going to be cycle peak on headline CPI inflation. So that, you know, is directionally good. And if I'm Jerome Powell, I probably do have a smile on my face, and I'm glad that energy prices went my way. But let's, you know, get real here, people. I mean, 8.5% on your headline and a core that was really unched at close to 6% is nowhere near a sustainable level. It's three times your target of 2%. And look, we know throughout history, if Jerome Powell is really the student of history that he claims to be, if he really thinks he's, you know, Paul Volcker, then he knows that it's going to be very hard for him to take his foot off the accelerator on the Fed funds rate until the Fed funds rate is approaching core CPI. And if you look throughout history, most Feds that are trying to fight inflation have to get to that point. So inflation coming down towards something closer, having core inflation come down to something below 4 means, you know, he still has about another 150, 175 basis points to go on Fed funds. And he's probably going to have to get there sooner rather than later. So to answer your question, you know, September, was looking like 50. We had a brief moment last week on the labor data, which was super hot, where, you know, some exuberant folks said, oh, it's got to be 75. And now we're back to 50. So we've kind of round tripped. I don't think there's a lot of new news in this other than the direction is correct, but the levels are wrong.
So do you think the market pricing is right to think 50 in September? I mean, is there any scenario where we could go back to the old world of 25 basis points by September?
It would be hard to get to 25, I think. And that's just, again, the distance and speed here between that core, where core inflation is and where our current Fed funds rate is. I think they need to keep their foot on the accelerator. Obviously, if labor markets completely crap out, maybe they would downshift to 25. But I think it would really take two bad labor reports, meaning the one for August and the one for September, which they won't have at the next meeting. I should be clear, for them to really downshift that much.
Well, speaking of the labor market, we also had that super, super good jobs number on Friday. And I'm wondering if that also at all has changed your view on what the Fed might be doing or your outlook.
It doesn't change our outlook. To the contrary, it kind of reaffirms a thesis that we've had out there for a while, which is that, you know, we're going to all look back on the COVID pandemic as this massive generational shock to the labor market, where we fundamentally restructured as a society globally how we think about work, about where we work, how we work, how many days a week we work, whether we work in essential jobs that are deemed by our society as essential workers or non-essential workers. And this is really pretty profound. And so, you know, what we've been articulating a thesis that says, look, we think that there's structural change to this labor market, whether we're talking about more folks retiring, fewer immigrants entering, more folks detaching from the labor market and going the entrepreneurial route or going the gig route. And this is a labor market that is much more fluid, where people are much more willing to geographically relocate, embrace the ideas of remote opportunities and live wherever they want. And that's causing big demand supply imbalances in the labor market. And we think they're going to persist for a couple of years now, keeping inflation somewhat above that 2% target for the Fed.
It's interesting you bring that up, because when I think about that flexibility of labor, this year is one thing. Obviously, this super tight labor market. But looking further out, is that potentially sort of deflationary towards wages? You know, if I can work in, you know, the middle of the country instead of having to live in New York, does that sort of suppress wages in the longer run, do you think?
No, actually not. And the reason is that companies, you know, have jobs in specific locations, the vast majority of companies, right? I mean, Amazon may be located and have its headquarters in one place, but it needs workers to deliver packages in all 50 states or all, you know, whatever, 300 countries around the world. And so, you know, they need workers. So if people are, you know, relocating and in transit, that's going to drive up wages in the places that are, quote unquote, maybe less desirable for, you know, new employees to live or to be. And you still have to attract those employees to get the jobs done.
And Lisa, just to bring us back to the markets, Mike mentioned at the top that stocks are up something like 15% since mid-June. And I wanted to ask you what, in your view, is behind the recent market resilience?
Yeah. So look, I think really from January to June, you know, our analysis has been that this has been a very, very textbook bear market. And what I mean by that is that, you know, we saw a very clear, very well telegraphed pivot in Federal Reserve policy that was unequivocally driven by a Fed that was massively behind the inflation curve. As a result, the market had to discount a hike in Fed funds rate. So real interest rates moved up and price earnings ratios moved down. And it was in a very clear kind of linear mathematical formula. And so the first, you know, 20-24% drawdown on the S&P 500 from January 24th, the middle of June, you know, was very textbook. Really from there, I think we're getting a very typical reflexive bear market rally, meaning you get a pause. It looks like the Fed says we're going to now be data dependent. You know, folks think the data is going to get more constructive. And, you know, we get folks thinking that they're, you know, going to find some bargains, and they go in and they find the bargains where things have sold off the most. And some of the biggest damage, as we know, was in the unprofitable tech space, some of the meme stock space, and some of the more, you know, core pieces of the NASDAQ and FANG. And so that's driven this hope that the worst is over. Has driven the bottom fishing back in. But folks who are true students of the market know that in every bear market, we have these retracement rallies. They are head fake rallies. And the reason is that we have to understand that it's not enough for price earnings ratios to come in. Policy operates with a lag and it has an impact. It slows the economy. And if the economy slows, corporate profits go down. It's just a fact. It's math. And so we have not seen those earnings estimates come down yet. And that's really what we're waiting for. And, you know, what we have found, you know, perhaps, you know, most curious is what we have said is that the drawdown on corporate profits is going to be relatively modest. It's only going to be 10 to 15%. And we have people calling us bearish. You know, I remind people, you know, in the last three recessions, right, 91, 01, and you know, the great financial crisis, you know, you're looking at drawdowns in profitability anywhere from 35 to 60%, right? So if S&P 500 profits are down, you know, 10 to 15% over the next 12 months, that's not too bad.
Join Bloomberg in San Francisco or virtually on May 7th for The Future Investor, Data-Powered Transformations. This 2024 event series will examine how data is not only playing a pivotal role in investment decisions, but serves as a driving force behind the construction of innovative, investable enterprises. This series is proudly sponsored by Invesco QQQ. Register at BloombergLive.com/futureinvestor/radio.
From Silicon Valley to Wall Street, the promise and perils of artificial intelligence are playing out on the world stage. But what will the next phase of AI adoption look like? Which companies, from big tech to startups, will dominate? And where do the risks and unintended consequences lie? I'm Emily Chang. Join me at Bloomberg Tech in San Francisco, May 9th, to answer many of the industry's burning questions, alongside Snap's Evan Spiegel, Xbox President Sarah Bond, OpenAI's Brad Lightcap, top researcher Dr. Fei-Fei Li of Stanford, and many more. More details and just a few tickets left at Bloomberg.com/TechSF.
Can I actually ask you to say more about the idea that we are in a bear market rally? Because historically, they tend to be very frequent, right? And I think in one of your recent notes, you said there may be more headwinds ahead, and the market just isn't pricing them in yet. And I want to ask you what those are.
Yeah, sure. I mean, you know, if we think about, you know, some of the things that could, you know, suddenly become additional headwinds, not only economic slowing, but one of the other things is, you know, the U.S. dollar. If, in fact, the Fed starts easing up on their rate hiking cycle, it's entirely possible that the U.S. dollar, which has been extraordinarily strong, you know, moves in a different direction. And that, believe it or not, for the average consumer is inflationary. So that, you know, suddenly, you know, throws a wrench into the works. Another, you know, factor that you know, we remind people of is be careful what you wish for. You know, inflation is actually a really good thing for companies in the long run, particularly companies that have brand franchise, because they take pricing power and they pass it through. And so if we look at the last couple of quarters of S&P 500 earnings, you have a lot of companies talking about their pricing power. Well, guess what, guys? If inflation goes down, you lose your ability to pass on price, and immediately you're taking a hit to the bottom line. So you can't have it both ways. And so things like a change in the U.S. dollar, things like a recession, you know, things like a loss of pricing power are all additional headwinds that we just don't think we're not hearing some of the clients who are buying into this bull market rally, or bear market rally, I should say, talk about.
So if I were an investor and I wanted to screen for sort of stocks that have the best type of pricing power, how would you go about that? I mean, is it as simple as looking for, you know, whose sales growth is keeping up with inflation? Or do you go, you know, go announcement by announcement to see which companies have actually raised prices? What's the best way to kind of, you know, grasp that pricing power in the market?
Yeah. So, you know, the way we usually think about pricing power is, you know, who are the guys who are growing their sales more quickly than they're growing their volumes, than their unit volumes? And does it intuitively make sense, you know, vis-a-vis the strength of their brand franchise? Meaning, if you are a consumer product, if you're Nike sneakers, for example, and suddenly, you know, you've got, you know, two new models, you're able to hold or increase prices at a rate faster than your unit volume is selling through. That would be a suggestion to us that maybe you have pricing power. Some companies have already said, you know, they're starting to see their margins compress. They're already feeling the lack of that pricing power where their costs are growing faster than their revenues.
Is it as simple as sort of the higher end, you know, companies selling to the higher end consumers are going to be able to do that better than the Walmarts and the lower end retail?
No, not at all. I mean, we have, you know, a bunch of franchises that serve lower end consumers who, you know, seem to be, quote unquote, getting it done. Look at McDonald's. McDonald's has had some very good pricing power during you know, this most recent part of the business cycle. So, you know, it really, you've got to look at it company by company.
I feel like my inbox has never been more divided in terms of some of the research notes I'm getting. I have half of the thing of the notes saying it's a bear market rally, and the other half saying this thing is for real. And so I'm just wondering, how difficult is it to come up with a thesis right now, and what are you telling clients who are potentially looking to get invested?
Yeah, so look, it legitimately, this is a complex environment. None of us who are in the business today, even folks who have been doing it 20, 30, 40 years, have ever dealt with the aftermath of a global public health pandemic. None of us have ever, dealt with the amount of stimulus that we got in a 12-month period, which was close to $9 trillion, four from the Fed and five from Washington. That equates to 45% of annual GDP. I mean, just think about that for a minute, how much liquidity is in this economy. And so we've never really been in this situation where we're raising rates this fast from those heights. And while a lot of people want to make the analogy to other times the economy has soft landed, and, you know, other times, like, you know, when Greenspan was able to soft land the economy, he wasn't facing kind of the geopolitical instability that the world is facing today, whether you're talking about relations between, you know, U.S. and Russia and the Russia-Ukraine war and the pressure that's putting on Europe, which is extraordinary. I mean, think about if I told you that Europe was going to be rationing energy. No. Okay, that's what's happening. So extraordinary pressures in the global economy. And then, of course, there's U.S., China, not to mention the dysfunction in the U.S. itself. So, you know, this is a really, really, really tough environment to call. That having been said, right, as much as we all want to talk about this time is different, we also know that very rarely is it completely different, and it usually, quote unquote, rhymes. And so when we think about where could we be rhyming with history, right, the places we know we rhyme with history is that typically, right, bear markets don't end until certain things happen, right? So bear markets tend not to end, right, unless unemployment has peaked. Bear markets that are related to inflation and policy scares don't tend to end until, you know, leading economic indicators trough. These kind of bear markets don't tend to end until, you know, the orders to inventory ratio, you know, turns positive. So there's a bunch of things that we could say if we're looking for rhymes with history. We think that we're still in this bear market and we've got a ways to go.
I was really hoping you were going to rhyme that at the end there. I would have been such a lost opportunity.
Yeah, you're right. Absolutely. But there's a reason. There's a reason I work on Wall Street and I don't rap. I have a picture of Jay-Z on my wall, but I'm.
Do you really?
I really do.
Okay. Well, if you start writing some raps, by all means, you know, you can debut them on the podcast anytime. We'd be happy to. Yeah, but Lisa, I want to get back to that notion of how growth seems to be back from the dead. And I get the impression you're more of, at least at the moment, you're more of a bottoms-up stock picker type than somebody who wants to chase factors back and forth. But to me, what's fascinating about growth is we had this period between, the aftermath of the financial crisis and COVID, where it seemed like a simple equation, low growth economy, low inflation, growth stocks just take off in that type of environment. Now we've had the pandemic, the recovery, obviously value had its moment in the sun there. The last month and a half, though, growth is outperforming again. I know you're skeptical on that growth rebound, but I want to ask you basically two things. If you could unpack for us why you're skeptical on the growth rebound, but also, is that sort of new normal that we saw in that period between the GFC and COVID, where growth just was the perennial outperformer? Are we ever going to get back to that? I mean, to me, it seems like if the economy ever gets back to normal, we'll revert back to that sort of equation where growth is sort of the perennial favorite. Is that notion just gone forever, on the other side of COVID?
No, I don't think it's gone forever. Here's what I'd say. Look, I'm in the camp that says that the period after the great financial crisis, where, the United States economic growth was suppressed, where interest rates were suppressed, where inflation was suppressed, where capital spending was slow, where, productivity growth was awful, and wage growth was mediocre, that's actually the outlier in history. And while we can completely understand why, in an environment where long run real interest rates are consistently falling for almost, a decade going on 13 years, where growth would structurally outperform value, we do think that, we have not killed the business cycle. And because we haven't killed the business cycle, we believe that you want to, very oftentimes own more cyclical or more value oriented stocks. And we're not sure that you don't want to this time, especially if you're in the camp that we are, that says we're pretty confident that we could actually pull off a soft landing this time. It isn't a slam dunk that we're going into this deep, deep recession where you have to get ultra defensive and you have to only own secular growers. Our bullishness on the labor market is one component of that thesis. The second component is we believe that capital spending is going to remain pretty resilient. And that one of the things that's really different in this business cycle is that, COVID was a shock to business models. And almost every single business had to re-engineer themselves and think about how can I run this business with fewer people, with less human contact, right? And that has unleashed a level of innovation and capital spending and automation across every industry, that we think is pretty profound and has some legs. So that's a very long-winded way of us saying, look, we don't think the business cycle is dead, and therefore we don't think value investing is dead. And while there are a lot of growth-oriented stocks that I want to own, right, I don't want to just own the NASDAQ blindly.
I'm going to pull a mic and ask you a multi-part question.
She's learning.
Yeah.
Yes.
My tutelage has paid off. I don't like to do it typically. But so can you talk about what you like within value? And then on all the way on the other end of the spectrum, we've also had this resurgence in meme stocks, in crypto, and I'm wondering how you would go about characterizing what is happening in terms of like the speculative stuff that's seeing a resurgence.
Yeah, so, look, I think the speculative stuff is just as defined. It is speculative. It, in our humble opinion, was always premised on, market momentum and liquidity and the greater fool theory. I think that may be operating again here today. Absolutely nothing has changed to make the value proposition of some of those investing strategies any better. Now that we're 6 months into a Fed tightening cycle, I don't get it. I understand that, you know, some inexperienced investors may look at their charts and say, oh, goodness, look, here was the high and now here's where it is. I'm getting a bargain. I don't see that there was fundamental value there to begin with. So we wouldn't be going there. But where is there value in the market? I think there's a lot of places. A lot of pockets, right? So, we're buying some of the more traditional value, which is in financials, in energy, in industrials, in materials and mining. But we're also finding value throughout the healthcare sector. We're finding some across consumer services. There's some interesting things we think in home building. You know, our view is yes. Have we seen, you know, a meteoric rise in mortgage rates, and has that slowed the housing market? Yes, absolutely. But do we think the housing market is going to go into a multi-year recession? No, we don't, because we think that there's fundamental supply-demand imbalances. And so we think that there's some interesting things to buy even among home builders. Semiconductors, we know, have, you know, had a very typical textbook cyclical sell-off most recently. That there's going to be a time probably in the next 3 to 6 months where I want to own semis again. So, you know, we're looking at all these areas.
Someday they're going to get semiconductor supply and demand in equilibrium. Someday. I don't know if it'll be in our lifetime. But someday it's going to happen.
From Silicon Valley to Wall Street, the promise and perils of artificial intelligence are playing out on the world stage. But what will the next phase of AI adoption look like? Which companies, from big tech to startups, will dominate? And where do the risks and unintended consequences lie? I'm Emily Chang. Join me at Bloomberg Tech in San Francisco, May 9th, to answer many of the industry's burning questions, alongside Snap's Evan Spiegel, Xbox President Sarah Bond, OpenAI's Brad Lightcap, top researcher Dr. Fei-Fei Li of Stanford, and many more. More details and just a few tickets left at Bloomberg.com/TechSF. From Silicon Valley to Wall Street, the promise and perils of artificial intelligence are playing out on the world stage. But what will the next phase of AI adoption look like? Which companies, from big tech to startups, will dominate? And where do the risks and unintended consequences lie? I'm Emily Chang. Join me at Bloomberg Tech in San Francisco, May 9th, to answer many of the industry's burning questions, alongside Snap's Evan Spiegel, Xbox President Sarah Bond, OpenAI's Brad Lightcap, top researcher Dr. Fei-Fei Li of Stanford, and many more. More details and just a few tickets left at Bloomberg.com/TechSF.
Lisa, you know, they always warn guys like me at Thanksgiving, don't talk about religion, don't talk about politics. The bad news for you is, though, this isn't Thanksgiving dinner, so I do want to ask about politics a little bit. Because, you know, the one thing you hear over and over again and you read the research is that, look, midterm years, there's like a seasonality to the election cycle, and midterm years can be kind of historically a weak time for the equity market. Obviously, there's so much going on in the economy this year that who knows if that's really playing any role at all. But I want to ask, A, how are you thinking about these midterms, if there is any risk or opportunities in the market from what's expected? And also all this flurry of legislation that we've just seen, the CHIPS Act, you know, you're talking about semiconductors and the Inflation Reduction Act, which is very heavily on green energy and that sort of thing. Has the market sort of priced out all the positives and negatives from all this, or you know, are there any opportunities that are popping out that you think the market might have missed?
Yeah, so fantastic question, because again, I think right now the market is maybe not fully focusing enough on Washington. So, you know, just to answer the second part of your question first, you know, I think that some of the legislative dynamics coming out of Washington are extraordinarily positive for some key sectors. To your point, the amount of money that's going to be invested in domestic semiconductor capacity, unprecedented. The amount of money that's going to, you know, clean energy with this, what's left of the Build Back Better bill. I can't call it the Inflation Reduction Act. I just can't bring myself to do that. But, you know, and also just flying under the radar, you guys may have seen the Department of Energy is doing a $2.5 billion interest-free loan to General Motors to help them invest in electric vehicle battery capacity. So there's all of these kind of initiatives, which are also very good for economic growth. They're very good for capital spending. As we know from history, as much as people don't like it from a political perspective or from a debt and deficit perspective, they do tend to create jobs and they do tend, you know, to deepen capital and productivity in the long run. And I don't think that I'm seeing the market recognize, you know, all of that yet, nor are they necessarily recognizing that there are going to be a handful of companies, by the way, who have to pay taxes, who have not historically paid taxes. And that number is going to be about $300, you know, billion dollars off of S&P 500. Earnings in 2023. And again, I don't see earnings estimates coming down to reflect that yet. And so, you know, I'm not exactly sure why analysts are being, you know, so reticent about what's
maybe right. it's faith in the perennial ability for companies to dodge taxes, perhaps.
Of course. But you know, there's a little bit of that that I feel like is right in front of their face. But to the bigger part of your question, which is the midterms, you know, without getting to the substance of the midterms, because I don't know that there is going to be any substance to the midterms. What I think is the bigger risk that no one is talking about, and I know that it's, you know, great fodder for network news and it's great fodder, you know, for, you know, the internet and you know, politically oriented media outlets, you know, to ramp up the rhetoric here. But I think it's getting increasingly dangerous. And I'm not just talking about, you know, as an American, you know, the issue about is our democracy under assault. It's really quite more pedestrian than that. And that is, you know, United States capital markets are the destination for global capital. We are the world's reserve currency. The U.S. dollar is strong because of that. That gives Americans extraordinary purchasing power. It also allows us to finance what are increasingly humongous debts at below market rates that we don't necessarily acknowledge every day. And so I think if we get into a scenario where, you know, people think that it is normal to litigate the outcome of elections and not seat Congress, if we get to a place where we're not seating congressmen in 3, 4, 5 states because we're litigating outcomes, I think that we got to really start thinking about that, you know, that maybe this, you know, political war has gone too far, because our credibility in the world matters. It matters. If you're an investor in American capital markets, you're a capitalist, this matters.
Yeah.
And people need to start behaving as if it matters. And I'm in the camp that says if we keep going down this path, there are going to be implications for the financial markets with regard to people's willingness and non-US citizens' willingness to engage.
I think that's a super, super important point that really hasn't resonated with a lot of people, especially if litigating those outcomes involves billy clubs and, you know, fighting with each other with flags and breaking windows. Lisa, really, really appreciate your thoughts today. I think we only have a limited amount of time left, so we can't let you go without getting to our crazy things of the week. So I hope you came prepared. Vildana, let's start with you.
Okay, mine is courtesy of my friend Julia Morpurgo. She's in the London office, so you'll remember I took a trip there and hung out with her a couple weeks ago. But she had this story on Domino's Pizza leaving Italy. So the last of Domino's 29 branches has closed in Italy after having just started in the country 7 years ago. And the company had borrowed very heavily and had planned to open 880 stores.
I'd love to meet the strategic genius who decided, you know what Italy needs is some Domino's
some
pizza.
Domino's
they love pizza.
More pizza,
over
pizza
there.
And Domino's pizza.
I know, that is a great one. That's pretty good. How about you, Lisa? Have you seen anything crazy this week?
Crazy? I'd probably not for publication on this podcast.
All right. Go ahead and spill.
That's fair.
Nah.
All right, I'll give you mine then before we leave. Vildana, have you ever seen the movie Grease?
Of course.
Okay, good. I don't know. I never know with your generation if you've seen the classics. I know Lisa's seen it. I don't even have to ask if Lisa's seen it.
Yes, thank you. I even know that, you know, Olivia Newton-John passed this week and, you know, her co-star, John Travolta, you know, couple that they will, you know, that he sent his very warm condolences.
Yeah. So RIP, rest in peace to Olivia Newton-John. And in her honor, I have a Grease-related crazy thing. It's an auction coming up, and this information is courtesy of the Rob Report website, by the way. Remember the drag race scene in Grease where John Travolta races the bad guy who's known as Craterface, by the way? It was odd back then. If you won the drag race, you not only won the car, you also won the girl. I don't know. I don't know if that's still valid these days. Hopefully we've progressed past that. But that used to be the case. So he won not only the hot rod, but Olivia Newton-John. So a very successful race for John. But the bad guy's car, it was the black 1949 Mercury Hot Rod, had the flames on the side and everything. That is up for auction. It comes complete with an autograph on the dashboard from Olivia Newton-John, Sandy herself, who I got to say, I think every guy my age had a crush on back in the day. But only when she went bad. When she went bad with the leather pants and the
grease back there.
That's she won a lot of hearts with that look. But so it's time to play The Price is Precise.
Wow.
Let me hear you say it.
It's time to play The Price is Precise.
Now, it hasn't gone up for sale yet, so all we know is what the auction house believes will be the range. So let's go with the high end of the range. Vildana, you start. What do you think the high end of the range? And I'm shielding my notes here so you don't see.
Yeah, because we're sitting next to each other.
Yes.
Okay, I'm going to go with $2
million. $2 million. $2 million.
Wait, no, I want to revise.
Okay.
$1.2 million. $1.3 million.
$1.3 million is, Lisa, is that price precise or, you know, price is precise rules?
Or might you say, is that price correct?
You could say that. One could say that. But I that is an honor. What was the guy's name? Chris Whitman in London who gave us that price.
Thank you,
is
Chris.
Precise. Lisa, remember the, you know, you can go over or under. You don't have to give an exact dollar figure.
I think you're over.
I think this is why she's a chief investment officer.
And I'm not.
And right.
And I'm not. That's,
you're every auction house's dream. You're always like $10 billion for that baseball card of the guy who never played. High end $750,000 for the Mercury Hot Rod. Hell's Chariot was the name of the car.
I was close.
But here's the question.
Not too far off. Yeah, not too bad.
Here's the question. What did the NFT of it sell?
Triple.
Right?
Yes. First, we have to blow it up, and I guess you videotape and make it an NFT. So we'll see. We'll check back on that and see if that's what happened. But Lisa, I know you've got a busy day ahead and need to get on with it. We can't thank you enough for your insights and your time today, and I hope we can have you back again in the future.
100%. Thank you, guys. A lot of fun.
Thank you, Lisa.
Take care. Bye-bye.
What Goes Up will be back next week. Until then, you can find us on the Bloomberg Terminal website and app or wherever you get your podcasts. We'd love it if you took the time to rate and review the show on Apple Podcasts so more listeners can find us. And you can find us on Twitter. Follow me at Reganonymous. Vildana Heirich is at Vildana Heirich. You can also follow Bloomberg Podcasts at Podcasts. What Goes Up is produced by Stacey Wong. Thanks for listening. See you next time.
Countdown has begun. From May 14th to 16th, 1,000 global leaders will gather in Doha for the Qatar Economic Forum powered by Bloomberg. Join heads of state, influential ministers, and leading CEOs to make new connections, gain unique insights, and uncover valuable opportunities in one of the world's most rapidly rising regions. Request your invite for this exclusive event at QatarEconomicForum.com.
Join Bloomberg in San Francisco or virtually on May 7th for The Future Investor, Data-Powered Transformations. This 2024 event series will examine how data is not only playing a pivotal role in investment decisions, but serves as a driving force behind the construction of innovative, investable enterprises. This series is proudly sponsored by Invesco QQQ. Register at BloombergLive.com/futureinvestor/radio.